This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And what we have here is not narrative, but it's some laws, and it's a very interesting section about the sutta. It's the first time that we have a major female issue in Sefer Bamidbar.
And
this is the book of Bamidbar.
Yeah.
It's the fourth of the five books. The Bereishit deals with the period from the creation until the arrival in Egypt. Of Yaakov and his sons, and Yaakov's death is the end of Bereshit. Shemot deals with the Exodus, so that's from the arrival in Egypt, going out of Egypt, the splitting of the Red Sea, the beginning of the desert period, the giving of the Torah, and the building of the Mishkan and the temple. The kelim, all the utensils and so on for the temple, and the Kohanim's clothes and functions are discussed in Shemot. Vayikra is all sacrifices, except for the parasha of Kedoshim, which deals with a lot of very interesting laws. A lot of the really important laws are squashed into parasha of Kedoshim, which is in Vayikra. And then Bamidbar is a bit of a mixture. Bamidbar takes place during the desert period. Bamidbar means in the desert. And it's a partial narrative, partial laws. The laws that were given during that period. And a little bit of narrative, but not an awful lot of narrative. So that's the book of Vayikra, of Bamidbar. And in the Sedra of Naso, which is the second parasha of the book of Bamidbar, it starts off with some. The first part of Bamidbar deals with, in English, Bamidbar is called Numbers because it's the whole first few chapters of counting how many people there were, how many people in each tribe, how many people in the different families of Kohanim and Levim and so on. But after that, the laws start, and the laws just before the section on the sutta are the laws of certain portions that we have to give to the Kohen.
What is that
for? Sota, we'll try and work out what it means. It's a the treatment of a woman who's of a wife who's suspected of being unfaithful. Is the the sentence, in fact, before the sota, and that's quite an important one. The ish et kedashav lo yihyu, and each man, his holy tithes are his own. Ish asher yitain la kohen lo yihye. Each man who gives it to the kohen, it is his. And the Gemara learns, and Rashi brings it, what it's teaching us is that while one has no choice about giving the tithe, one has to give that to the Kohen, one is free to choose which Kohen to give it to. A Kohen cannot demand it, because one is free to choose which Kohen to give it to. The various different tithes that we still do today, we don't give it to a Kohen, but we're not allowed to eat it. So when we eat produce from Israel, we have to check the Truma and Maaser has been taken, or else we have to take it ourselves. And what we have to take is a 100th portion, 100th of whatever one's eating or whatever one has purchased, would go to the Kohen. A 10th would go to the Levi. Oh, sorry, let's go around. A 10th would go to the Levi, that's Maaser. Of that, and then Truma is anything, any portion, there's no minimum requirement. So it's a tenth plus something we're not allowed to eat. And of the tenth, a tenth of that tenth goes to the Kohen, because the Levi also has to give a tenth to the Kohen. So what we have to take off is the tenth we're allowed to eat today, but we're not allowed to eat the hundredth. So what we would have to take off today is the part that would normally go to the Kohen. So what would normally go to the Kohen again? You have a piece of fruit, but you divide it into 100. In the time of the Beis Hamikdash, what would you have had to give? A tenth. So 10 sections you would have to give to the Levi. He would have to give one section to the Kohen. So one section of the fruit we cannot eat. Plus, we would also have to give something to the Kohen. So what we're not allowed to eat today is 100 plus a little more. And that's what we would remove from food before we ate it.
What are they
doing on Israel? You take it off. It's not just in Israel. It's in fact here too. If you eat something from Israel, and we're not sure that a lot of the stuff, trim and mice, has been taken off, especially the exported goods, but occasionally it is. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you throw it out. You just don't eat it. So, but it has kedusha attached to it. It has a certain amount of sanctity. So you wrap it in something before you throw it out. You don't just throw it into the garbage. You wrap it up and put it away. It's not batash because you're not allowed to use it.
But isn't that wasting?
No, the only wasting is something which you are allowed to use and you don't use. Something you're not allowed to use and you don't use, you're doing the right thing. And there's a special thing to say, and then there's truma samaisa, so there are a few other things that go with it. Sharon?
Rabbi, I just said that there is a problem now in LA. There are stores that are importing things from Israel. And there are labels Carmel, mostly tomatoes on the vine, and
did he say Truma has not taken or might not have been taken? Really? No, that's problematic. That's really problematic. And one of the easiest thing is not to buy Israeli. Yeah, it's easy just not to buy because it's really. Yeah. Unless you're getting the Israeli things with a Hechsher or it's a brand that is taken care of, so the Jaffa oranges and things like that, usually Truma and Maisa is taken from. And right after that starts the Sotah Parsha. And the Sotah Parsha reads as follows. And just very briefly, the story with the Sotah is a man sees that a relationship is building between his wife and somebody else. He warns her that he doesn't want her alone with that person. She ignores the warning and is found to be alone with that person. He brings her to the Kohen. She agrees to drink from the Mei Sota, special water, which we'll discuss how they made that. And if she had a relationship with a man that she was alone with, she would die. That's what the effect of the water was. And if she had not had a relationship with him, she would thrive. That was the effect of the Sota, and that's very briefly the process, but we'll get into it in some detail. So it says by Yidaber Hashem on Moshe Lemor, this is in chapter 5, verse 11. No chumashim at all today. Oh, that's a record. I fired my Gemara shiur this morning because they came without Gemaras and not prepared in anything. So I fired my whole Gemara shiur this morning.
Oh.
Yeah, it isn't Mr. Khan, I told you. He didn't tell you that I fired the Gemara shiur.
Did you hire her back at the end?
No, they're going to have to reapply, and only those who committed to learning seriously. And we'll do something else on Friday. They like stuff on Friday morning. They don't want to be entertained. I'll entertain them on Friday morning, but those who want to learn Gemara will let me know, and we'll make a separate time, because they come, and I should the same with the Chumash. You should come with the Chumash. Studying the Chumash, this is written law, it's not oral law. We're in Bamidbar. I'll let you know before we go on to the next book. You should have a Chumash in front of you that you can see it inside, see the words, see what they mean. Now, I'm not on stage, this is not an act, it's not a show, we're learning.
You don't want to be fired.
You don't want to be fired.
Well, we'll be next week. Come on,
Lauren, first thing that
if you're fired, if it's entertainment you want, then Des is going to provide the entertainment. And I will. Daber ben Israel, speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, Ish, any man, ki tiste ishto, whose wife is sota, whatever that we're going to have to analyze, what that word means, where it comes from, what it means. very strange, there's a very strange use of language here. That first one is tisteh. And it means it has all sorts of layers of meaning, which we'll analyze. Umalavo ma'al. And here again, a very strange word. Me'ilo is normally used as the transgression of using something in the Beit HaMikdash for secular use. So if there's an object that is dedicated for use in the temple and you use it for ordinary use, that's called me'ilo. It's a very serious avera. Not allowed to do that. So if there's a knife that the Kohen uses to slaughter a sacrifice with and you use it to cut your Shabbat roast with, that's me'ilo. That's very serious. We're not allowed to do anything like that. And here that same word is used. Me'ilo could also mean treachery. It has all sorts of shades of meaning as well. U'mo'alov o'malim. It's used in a double sense. And she commits me'ilo with him. And again, mo'al. It's just strange, very strange form. Then it says, v'shochav ish oiso. And a man had slept with her. But we'll check whether that really means that. Shichbazer and had sexual relations. V'ne'alam me'inei isho. But he's not aware of it. V'nistero. And she is alone with him. V'hi nitma'o. And she has been defiled. V'eid einbo. But there is no evidence. V'hi lo nistaso. And she was not courted. So has she? Didn't she?
But he didn't know about it?
He didn't know. There were no evidence. But she did. It's all very confusing. The avar olav ruach kino, and a spirit of kino. Kino also has a lot of different meanings. It can mean passion, it can mean intensity, it can mean jealousy, it can mean anger, it can mean warning. The kineis ishto, and he, that's translated, and he warned his wife, the hinitmo, and she was defiled. Or avar olav ruach kino the kineis ishto, or he became concerned and warned his wife. But he loyed his wife. She was not defiled. Wasn't. The heviyo ishes ishto elako, and the man will bring his wife to the kohen. The heviyas korbano eleho, and he will bring her sacrifice for her. Asiviso efa kemach soirim, a tenth of an efa of barley flour. Lo yitzoika lov shemen, there should be no oil brought with it. Lo yiten olav levoino, and there should be no levoino spice with it. Because this is a flower offering of jealousy or of anger, an offering of memory and a memory of sin. Very, very strange. And the Kohen will bring her near, and stand her before God. And the Kohen will take holy water in an earthenware utensil, umin ha'ofer asher yeh b'karka ha'mishkan, and a little bit of dust from the earth of the Mishkan, of the Beis HaMikdash, yikach ha'kohen, the Kohen will take, v'nosan al ha'moyim, and he'll sprinkle that on the water. V'hemid ha'kohen eso isho lifnei Hashem, and the Kohen will place the woman in front of Hashem, ufora es roisho isho, and he will remove her head covering. Everybody asks, where does it say in the Torah that a married woman's head is covered? This is the way it says it. This is the only source that we have. He said he will remove her head covering, implying that there was that her hair was covered. V'nosan al kapeo es minchas avikoren, and he places in her hands the offering of the memory, the flower offering, minchas kenosi. U'v'yad akoren yiyume hamorim ha'arim, and in the Kohen's hand is the bitter waters. V'hishbia iso hakoren, and the Kohen will make her swear, v'omar elo isha, and will say to her, in if no man has slept with you and you have not been defiled while married to your husband, these waters will not damage you in any way. But if you did deviate and you were defiled, and you have had a sexual relationship with somebody other than your husband, the Kohen will make him take this oath, and the Kohen says to the woman, may God make you as an oath of a curse among your people, your your womb will collapse, your thighs will fall, very terrible curse. And these bitter waters will come into your insides, sleep voice bet and alarm for your to collapse and contract you. And the woman says, Amen, I accept that. He writes these curses down and he erases them in the water. So he writes them with God's name. This is very interesting. He writes them and has God's name. Yitain Hashem Oisach. He writes God's name, Yud K Vav K, not a Dalad or a Hey or anything. He writes the full name of Hashem on a parchment, and then he dips the parchment into the water. So God's name is erased off the parchment and is now in the water. The Hishko is a Ishos Me Amorim Hamorim, and he gives the woman to drink from these bitter waters. Uvovo Amayim Hamorim Lamorim, and the bitter waters will become more bitter. He then takes the Lokach Kem Yad Ishos Min Chasa Kanois, he takes the sacrifice from the woman's hands. The Hinifa Samin Cholit Ne Hashem, he waves, he moves the sacrifice in front of God. The Kriba Yisrael Amizbeach, he brings it to the altar. And it goes on to say, and if it is so, she, after drinking the water, she collapses. The imloinit ma'ayisho sohirohi. However, if the woman was not defiled, then she is clear. The nixor, the nizra, or zora. She becomes cleansed and she becomes pregnant. Not immaculately, but from her husband. And is blessed. There's a great deal of blessing afterwards that comes if she's clear. That's the long and the short of the parasha of Sota. Now the first thing that the Chazal do is they link this parasha of the Sota to the previous one of the Kohen. What do you think the linkage is? Rashi says, Ma kosuv lemala min ha'inyan, what is written just before the parsha of the Sota? The ishet kadoshov lo yihye. The person must bring his tithes to the Kohen. Im atom ma'akev matnos ha'kohen, if you withhold the gifts of the Kohen, chayecho shitztarech lavoyet lo lavi lo esa Sota. Don't think you won't need a Kohen. You'll need him for Sota. So there is a strange linkage between the man who withholds his tithes and the breakdown in his relationship with his wife. What is the linkage, do you think? Why would that be the linkage? So he's showing miserliness, he's showing meanness. So in other words, expect that if there's... It's so interesting because right at the very opening of the parish of Soto, it introduces something that we don't see in the words itself. Some level of responsibility on the husband. That she's the one who goes through all this, and she's the one, and she's the one, and so on, and we'll discuss why. But what about him? Is he completely faultless? The Gemara starts off by saying, no, you see from the positioning of this that he needs to check. Not check his relationship with her, because no man thinks that he's mean to his wife. And he'll never notice that there's anything wrong in his relationship with her. Check your generosity to the Kohen. Because if you haven't been giving charity properly, if you haven't been generous with the Kohen, the chances are you're not generous with your wife either. Because generosity is normally not a function of how you are to a particular individual. One either has the characteristic of generosity or one doesn't. And when a man is mean with his money, the chances are that there are problems at home. That linkage is established here. That doesn't resolve her from responsibility at all. Remember our old principle, two people can each be 100% responsible. The fact that he is partially responsible doesn't mean that she is less responsible. She is fully responsible for what she does. This is no justification for her to do what she's doing. But it does alert us to the fact that there is a linkage between her seeking satisfaction. What is she likely to get? How do these things start? Why is she going with this guy? Jump into bed with him the first time she met him. But what is the first thing he's likely to do? The seducer. What is the first thing he's likely to do? Yes, to seduce her with gifts and money and dinners and things. That's how it is.
No, maybe he's talking to her.
Well, that's second. That's second.
And the husband is not.
That's second. That's usually second, because how's the environment for them to do that? If it's that.
If this is a problem in her marriage, the gifts are not what she's looking for. She's looking for somebody who's going to pay attention to her, to connect with her.
Yes, what do gifts mean? What did we say when we discussed the whole question of the ring at a wedding and why it's important and why money is one of the ways that you acquire a wife? Because one of the first way of paying attention is when a woman feels I'm important enough for him to spend money on, is the first indication that there's a potential relationship. And a man talks to her, so lots of people stop and talk to her, but when he starts spending money on her, there is an indication of investment. And when a person is willing to invest in another person, a relationship has been established. And yes, that investment might be time, that investment might be interest, there might be all sorts of things, but the easiest and usually the first investment will be a serious one. Yes, they'll have a cup of coffee together and they'll talk and she'll have a pleasant time. But that's not the end of the world. That's not where it starts going wrong. There's nothing wrong with her having a conversation with a man. That's not where it starts going wrong. Where it starts going wrong is where she's accepting financial investment. Because what does that financial investment imply? Indebtedness. And that's where it starts going, that's where the slide starts setting in. And they're having a cup of coffee. He's talking to her, she's talking to him. They leave the thing equally. He's had some company, she's had some company. There's not indebtedness. But when he starts with the gifts, there is indebtedness. Now, what is the protection of that indebtedness as far as she's concerned? Is that she doesn't need gifts from anybody else. That she doesn't respond to gifts from anybody. She doesn't like gifts from anybody else. That would be an indication that that at least that part of it is in order. So from the flow of the previous one, the flow of the previous one is there is an obligation of generosity. A man needs to be generous. He needs to be willing to give away what he has to the Kohen. If he's trained in that generosity, it will be easy for him to be generous in his family relationships as well. In South Africa, it used to be the custom that when people used to give money, when rabbis used to come around collecting for yeshivas, and I'm saying used to, going back to the older generation, going back 30 years or so and more, that what would happen is when the rabbi would come, the business builder, the man, the donor, would always call the children in and teach the children, show the children how you give charity, that you give charity. And in the next generation, these were not religious people. South Africa was one of the few places that supported, the people who supported Torah were not the religious people. There were no religious people there. So you had irreligious people giving vast amounts of money. The whole of Ponovi's yeshiva, the whole of Bnei Brak was built on South African money. And not one of them was religious. And when those people gave money, that's what they used to do. I've seen it many, many times. When the rabbi would come in and immediately the man would say, just hold on, I want to get my son in, I want to get my children in, introduce them and sit down and watch the whole process. And those families that didn't do it, that next generation doesn't know how to give charity. So in South Africa today, you have a generation of very wealthy people who've become wealthy now recently, along with everybody else getting wealthy. Their parents weren't wealthy. So they never saw charity being given, and they're not giving. Charity is something you learn to give. A parent teaches a child to give charity. And when one learns to give charity, when one learns to part with money, that impacts not only on the poor, that impacts on the man's capacity to invest financially in other people. And so we set this off with the wobble comes from the generosity side. And what happens now? She wonders of what does this word sota mean to stay? It comes from the word, a few different sources for it. The one is the Ibn Ezra says to stay is tasuma derech ha'esha. It's a deviation. Stia, we use it even in modern Hebrew. A deviation, a detour, is called a stia, a moving from the straight and narrow. Rashi gives another reason for the word and says it's similar to the word shote. Sota and shote are the same words, the same letters, just the voweling is different. And he quotes the Gemara that says, it's a medrash in the Tanchuma, Ein hamana'afin no'afin, ad shtikanes bohem ruach shtus. a married woman and a man only have an affair if they go mad. There is a madness, and shote means mad, means insane. There is an insanity to that kind of a relationship, because it cannot lead to anything good and constructive. And therefore, the word sota, says Rashi, comes from the word shote. There is an insanity. And where does the insanity come from? Well, it comes from love, or it comes from all sorts of things. Once there is an emotional drive that has no rational basis to it, the outcome is insanity. Is whether you know we like to look at insanity only as negative things, of people who are mad, but anybody who's doing anything irrational is doing something insane. And there is nothing rational about that kind of a relationship. If there was a problem at home, then they should have got divorced, and she should have then found another husband, and that's what would have been the rational approach. The fact that while she's married, she's getting into a relationship with him, that must mean that there's a level of insanity in that activity. Now, the next Rashi is key to the whole parsha, because the next Rashi gives another reason similar to the Ibn Ezra to what the word sotah means, and he says, Tat midarchei tzniut, she deviates. What does it mean, she deviates? She deviated from what? From darchei tzniut, from the mannerisms of modesty. And you'll remember, modesty is just not a good and adequate translation for the word tzniut. She deviates from the mannerisms of tzniut. And what is the outcome of a wife deviating from the mannerisms of tzniut? Batei chashed ve'enav, he becomes suspicious. And the whole of this parsha is not about reality, it's about perception. It's in fact the only parsha in the Torah that I can think of that deals so seriously with perception. Normally, how do we deal with perception? Go and find out the facts. Get evidence. Yeah, there's no attempt to get evidence. When the husband comes to the Kohen, and he comes with a story, and you saw as I read through it, that the Torah manages in its description of the situation to be so ambivalent. She was with him, she wasn't with him, she had a relationship, or she didn't, there weren't witnesses, but she did. It's all very confusing, because that's how he comes, and says, I don't know. I don't really know exactly what's happening. All I do know is that there's there is a relationship. I've warned her to keep away from this man, and I found them alone together. And the result of that, as far as he's concerned, is suspicion. The aid ain't by the Torah says there's no witness. The heel on his pastor, and she has not been caught at it. So all we're dealing with is the perception and the suspicion. So what is the suspicion? The Sipurnut speaks very interestingly on the words ma'ala v'ma'al. Remember I said to you, ma'ila is the use of a temple utensil for ordinary use. Why is that such a serious thing? Yeah, that sanctity is dedication. The word sanctity means to dedicate certain things for certain usage. And to be quite strict about that. That's part of what Kedusha is, a sense of occasion, a sense of this isn't the right time to be doing A or to be using B. And to actually reserve certain things for specific occasions. That intensifies the meaningfulness of the occasions on which they are performed or are used. And we do it in Jewish life. You see it quite often. You see it with certain foods for certain times. Why is it that Hamantashen for Purim and Kreplach for Wema and all these old Jewish traditions that the children should grow up with? It creates a certain sense. When you think of Rosh Hashanah, you think of certain tastes. You think of Purim. You think of, it's not just an intellectual thing. The child actually grows up associating the occasion with certain experiences that were only on that occasion. My mother used to be meticulous about not letting us have the most delicious things that were specific to a particular yontif. Not having it during the year. Not having Shabbos food during the week. You could tell from the food what the occasion it was. you should be able to tell from the clothing what occasion it is. You should be able to tell from the ambiance and the conduct what occasion it is. You create an occasion out of all those things, but you destroy an occasion if you use those things for other occasions. Then you destroy the special occasion. Not that you add to the other occasion. And in modern society, I'm finding an assumption that if something is good once a year, it's better twice as good twice a year. And it's 10 times as good 10 times a year. And it's 300 times as good if it's every day. It isn't. You dilute it each time. It's a dilution. It's not an addition. It's a dilution. And so it is with something. The idea of specialness requires restrictiveness. You cannot create specialness without restriction. If it's special, then its use is restricted. If its use is not restricted, then it isn't special. You can't do something every day and say this was a special occasion. It's not a special occasion. Only a special occasion if it's rare. And so it is with the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash. They were special because they were rare. They were special because their usage was restricted to one thing only. And the Tipunah says the following. So what's the Me'ilah here? Chilalo es Kodesh Hashem Asher Ohev. She has profaned the sanctity or the holy things of God which he loves, bekidushe ha'ishus, using tools of marriage such as chibuk v'nishuk, hugging and kissing, zulas isho v'domein, with someone other than her husband. Interesting thing. So he's not even going into the question of whether it was a physical, whether there was a proper sexual relationship or there wasn't. Irrelevant. The fact is there are gestures that are reserved for marriage. To use those gestures outside of marriage dilutes the specialness of the gesture. And that's the Me'ilah. And that's all the husband has to know. Now, it's not an issue. There are halakhic consequences as to whether they had a proper sexual relationship or they didn't. That would affect whether the husband and wife can live together or they can't. If a wife has had a sexual relationship with another man, then she can live with neither of them. She has to divorce herself from both of them. So there are halakhic implications as to whether there was a full sexual relationship. But that's not the issue here, says the Sifuna. The issue is the Me'ilah is that she has used tools dedicated for marriage in relationships other than marriage, which means she has reduced marriage to something more common. And how does he know that? How does the husband know that? Otherwise, why would they be in private? So to say that they've slept together, he doesn't know. But why would they have to go off privately? Why would they have to be in secret? If she wasn't using, if she wasn't doing just that. So at least that he assumes has taken place. And that's causing him to be very upset. That's causing him to feel that his marriage has been defiled in a way that it actually can't come right. And therefore there has to be clarity. The only way that relationship can ever recover is if there's clarity. And the only way that there can be clarity is by supernatural methods, because there are no witnesses. That would have to come before God in a way that he can know for sure that she has been cleared. And involved in that whole process is the potential for tragedy, which we'll have a look at. Why is the emphasis on her activities and not on him? In other words, what happens if it's the other way around? We don't have a parasha of male sotah. What happens if a woman comes along and says, I suspect that my husband has been, and so on? Why is there no such parasha? Because Judaism is unfair. Because man is? So that's really our question, is why is a man allowed to be polygamous and not a woman? And why would they create that way? And what is the source of that nature? So that's one reason. That's one reason. It would destroy any kind of genetic continuity of any kind of family structure. We wouldn't know who comes from who and what. There would just be no way of knowing anything. Um, answered that sometimes. But I don't know if that's altogether right. Let's go back to that. The need in the male and female, the man and the woman, for security in their marriage is paramount. Is that right? Both man and woman want security in their marriage. Not just in their marriage, they want security in everything. What's important in the man-woman relationship is the means of gaining that security is different. What is the difference? How does the man get his security in a marriage? What does a man want? How does a man feel secure in a marriage? What is his most important need? We discussed that before.
To be fully dedicated.
No, mm-hmm. No. What did we say is really important for him? What does he have to have? Yeah, he's got to have his ego kept intact. If she attacks his ego, it's over. And we discussed that and whether it is pathetic or it isn't pathetic, but it's just how it is. That at the end of the day, that's what he needs to be able to function and to feel secure. What does she need? And what does that mean? They both need love. But what love means to him and what love means to her is different. What love means to him is protect my ego. That's really what it means. Think that I'm the best guy in the entire world. Isn't that so? And if you don't think I'm the best guy in the entire world, he feels insecure. Mm-hmm. And if she does anything to make him think that there's somebody else in the world better than him, there's trouble. Right? She's not the same. She's open to it. She can have, he can say to her, you know, so-and-so is really beautiful, and so-and-so doesn't destroy her. As long as what? What has to be in place? What does she really need to do to feel together? And lots of women might not like this, but that's just how it is. She needs to feel fully invested in. And she needs to feel fully taken care of. She might be fully capable of taking care of herself. That doesn't matter. She wants somebody who can take care of her. And you'll find that... What I mean by that? I mean in every sense, physically and materially. A woman wants to know that she doesn't have to work. She would like to know that he can take care of her, that he would take care of her, that he would take care of her, to protect her and be physically there for her and be materially there for her. She needs, more than anything, a sense of belonging to. In fact, if you look at I think we discussed this in one of the shiur, what she really needs is a sense of being kind of possessed by. And you see that manifesting in various forms of relationship, of gesture, of sexuality, and of language in man-woman relationship. That if she looks up to him, if she admires and respects him, what her greatest sense of security is a sense of being possessed by him, not dominated and controlled. Remember we had a shiur where we talked about the difference in the word ba'al between control. What were the two words that I used? We used the difference in control and mastery. We said Baal, she wants to be mastered. Now listen to what the Medrash says. Why does it say ish? Because the Mishnah says it, the Medrash asks. It says in the Torah, ish, any man. But it really prefers to repeat it twice. Ish, a man, ki tiste ishto, whose wife goes off. Why does it say ish twice? She'afa pishi mishameshes le'echod, even though she's having one relationship, afa pikein l'shnayim he's a kuko, she is attached to two. That means she kuferis b'shnayim, she is being disloyal to two. The one that she's being disloyal to is her husband. She mizanahi kuferis b'isho, she is denying her husband. Shehifkid, and uses an interesting phrase here, shehifkid gufo etzlo, who deposited his body with her. He has given her something. He has given her something in trust. And the other is God, who's given her her soul in trust. So God has entrusted her with her soul, and her husband has entrusted her with her body. What does that mean? If marriage is about investment and possession and mastery, then when he allows her to go off on her own, what is he saying? You're mine. You're mine, but you're okay. I'm letting you be yours. I trust you. And she's undermining that trust. Now, a man doesn't want to be possessed. When a man is possessed by a woman, what does he feel? Claustrophobia. He runs. He runs a mile. That's the last thing he wants. A woman doesn't. I'm not talking about every man and every woman. We've often talked about there are men who enjoy the feeling of being possessed, and there are women who do not enjoy the feeling of being possessed. But we're talking generally in that relationship. A woman feels very secure if she feels possessed. If she feels, and not possessed as an object, possessed as taken total responsibility for. She feels enormously secure in that kind of an environment. But that means if you're my possession, when I let you go, I'm entrusting you with yourself who belongs to me, kind of. That's the kind of feeling. And she feels secure with that too. Imagine if I almost verbalized that. So you send your wife off saying, you're mine and I don't want to be without you, but I'm giving you to you for a while. I'm letting you take you. It's like I'm letting you take my car, my precious car today. You can take it. Just be careful with it. I'm letting you take my beautiful something, or she wants to say, to use something that's really precious, and he's got this magnificent camera that he prizes and takes, and she wants it. And he says, you can take it for the day. I'm kind of nervous, but it's okay. I trust you. Take it for the day. He says that to her each time she leaves him or he leaves her. You know, goodbye, my darling. You can have you for today. Just be careful. Look after yourself. You're precious to me. That should be the way he parts from her every day. And she says, sure, thank you, that's nice. And then goes and meets her boyfriend. That's the meal. That's what. Now, it doesn't work the other way around.
Yeah.
If she were to say to him, my darling, you're mine. I'm allowing you to go to work today. Just be careful that nobody else comes anywhere near you. That's not going to last long. Do you understand the different dynamics? That he, in order to function, does not want to feel possessed. She, in order to function, needs to feel possessed. That doesn't mean that it's okay for him. Not at all. The Torah would never allow that, and doesn't like polygamy. The Torah does not recommend it, even with proper marriage. And this, you'll remember, in New York, there was this whole thing with the Pilegish business 2 years ago, when there were religious communities that were encouraging men to take concubines. This is something completely against the Torah. There is no suggestion that it's good for a marriage for a man to do that kind of thing. Not at all. And that it's not undermining. Absolutely not at all. But is it sotah? No. Is it me'ilah? No. Is it a complete denial of the very essence of the entrustment? No. And if a woman sees it as that, there's a problem altogether. Do you follow that? You know, it's very hard in our society.
I don't follow that at all. If you tell me a man goes out on his wife and he's messing around on the side, and she's still home, and she's not giving to him what he needs. She doesn't see what he needs, but he's going out. There has to be something.
There's no justification for that. There's no justification for that, and there is. There's a whole lot on him. There's a whole lot on him, even if she goes out, as we've seen over here. So let's not minimize his responsibility. But there's no death sentence. There's no adultery in terms of he can't come back and reestablish the home. There's no me'ilah. It's not called me'ilah. So we've got to accept that activity, as negative and destructive as it is differentiated in some way from the same activity committed by the married woman. And we've got to understand what that difference is. That difference is in how they see each other away from one another. He has to see her as my precious belonging. Is not with me for a while. She does not have to see him in that light. And if she does see him in that light, he will run a mile.
But if he's not seeing her as his precious darling, and he's going out, then something's really amiss. So why is he there?
If he sees her as his precious darling and he's going out doing his thing,
yeah,
then there's something amiss, yes, because if she was such a precious darling and she wouldn't like what he's doing, he wouldn't be doing it.
Do it one more time.
If she is his precious darling and she doesn't like what he does, I mean, if she gives him permission,
yeah, to go out.
Yeah, imagine.
What woman is going to do
imagine.
That?
Imagine that she did. Imagine she gave him permission and said, that's okay, you want to have a good time, go and enjoy yourself as long as you come back. There would be nothing technically wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas if he gave her permission, there would be exactly the same technically wrong. There would be the same death sentence, exactly
right.
The same. It's not, there isn't the possibility, it's got nothing to do with permission, it's got nothing, so when the man does it, what the problem is breaking an understanding and damaging the wife. That's what it is. So it's an interpersonal issue. Here this is much more than an interpersonal issue. Here this is an undermining of the very essence of the nature of that relationship, irrespective of whether they agree to it or not, doesn't matter how open the marriage is. This has got nothing to do with open marriage. Because in that relationship, if you go back to what the marriage is, here is gold for you. I'm purchasing you. I'm acquiring you from your father. I'm now taking care of you. That's what, it's not we are now taking care of one another. That's why we don't give two rings under the chuppah. It's not we're buying one another, we're taking care of one another, we're loving one another. It's I am taking care of you. And the woman finds security in that. If that's what the marriage is, then this behavior is the breaking of that marriage. What he's doing is hurtful, but not necessarily breaking of that relationship. It's breaking of a trust, but it's not breaking of the purchase.
It's a breaking of relationship. How do you say it's not a breaking of trust for sure, but it's a breaking of relationship.
It's potentially breaking, but not of that relationship that took place with the handing over of the ring. The handing over of the ring was not I'm buying you and I won't buy any other cameras. The nature of that, there are whole.
The Torah has to recognize. All this wisdom is not going to be. This is boilerplate simple. This is not. We're not talking anything that's any harder to understand. That you are breaking a relationship if the man goes out on the woman. I understand that.
The difficulty, Laurie. The difficulty is not in the outcome of what you're saying. Yes, that in both cases you're breaking a relationship. That's obviously so. The difficulty is noting the difference, because the difference, what I'm trying to get here to here is that by understanding this difference, you understand the difference of a dynamic that can drive a man away and be attractive to a woman. That's how serious understanding this properly is. Because understanding it properly, it makes no difference in terms of the behavior of each party of outside. They're both bad, both destructive, both disloyal, both breaking a relationship. That goes without saying. That's not the issue. But technically the Torah treats them differently. Now, in understanding that technical difference, we understand, or we need to understand, the linkage, the dynamic that links husband and wife and their differences. Because if a husband and wife give each other a ring under a chuppah, what are two links? What are two rings? What do they create?
I think it's quality.
I think I call it a chain. Two links, that makes a chain. Okay, marriage is not about chains. Marriage is a transaction, and the image of those two people giving each other rings, creating that chain, creates an environment that is not what the Torah wants. And let's try and understand why it is. So I'm trying to go back to the difference in understanding. Why is her act more treacherous than his act? Not more disloyal, they're equally disloyal. Not more damaging, they're equally damaging. That's not the issue, and they're equally forbidden. The issue is only why does the Torah focus on that as me'ilo, as treachery? What is she doing that is in any way similar to using the Kohen's knife for your Shabbos pot roast? What is the issue there? What is she doing in that relationship? And there the understanding is that if her security lies in being possessed, you cannot be possessed and run off with somebody else. So if you don't want that kind of security, then don't get into a marriage. But if you want that kind of security, then you are his, because that's what makes you feel good. And when you're off on your own without him, it's almost at his pleasure. He allows you out of his sight. Not because he's a controlling, vicious monster, but because he treasures you, like he treasures his car and his camera and all the other precious things that he has. He doesn't let anybody else touch them. And he hits the roof if anybody else touches them. That's how he should be with his wife. And most wives would find that quite attractive. Right? If a man comes to another man and says, don't you touch my wife. Don't you look at her that way. And don't you speak to her that way. Because she's mine. And you don't touch my car. And you don't touch my camera. And you don't touch my house. And you don't touch my wife. And most women would feel very comfortable with that. If a woman... No. Today. Not every woman. Most women. Turn it the other way around and have a woman come up to another woman in front of a husband and say, "Don't you touch my husband. Don't you talk to him that way." And don't you ever that doesn't make the husband feel proud. So why not? Why doesn't it have the same effect on both of them? If the activity is the same, why doesn't the same response engender the same emotion? That's what we're dealing with in the Torah. Because the dynamics are different. The outcome is the same, but the dynamics are different. The woman wants to feel possessed, and she wants her husband to be jealous about her. That's what she wants, and that's why the word kinui is used here. The word kane is jealousy. That he comes, the husband's infuriated, and he's angry, and she finds some pleasure in that, some security in that. At least he cares. He does not find the same in her. It does not arouse the same kind of emotions in her, because this relationship is a different one. So whereas he can keep her involved through the passion of his restrictiveness in a kind of a way, that won't work the other way around. And too often women try and use the same, in our society of everything being equal and the same, women try and use the same mechanisms, and it blows, because that doesn't work with a man. It works with some men, but it doesn't work with the male element in a human being. Not that. There's a different approach that will work with a man, and she needs to be sensitive to that.
What is it?
We can discuss that in a moment. No, they're halakhically different, they're technically different, but I'm just giving that as an example of there can be a look and there can be a speech which is in itself not proper, not appropriate. And if the husband just stands around and tolerates it, that doesn't make her feel secure. That doesn't make her feel okay. And if the man would punch the other guy in the nose, that would make her feel even better. And that kind of primitive interaction is still there in that relationship, because people are still primitive. We haven't changed. We are the same human beings. Life has changed around us, but we as individuals have not changed at all. No evolution taking place. As human beings, the deep emotions that drive people, that's still the same as it always were, that it always was. We've obviously got to modify as we navigate our way through a changing environment, but people haven't changed. We've become more civilized, and more civilized means we've added layer and layer of veneer. But the fact is, if you look at it, probably the most uncensored movies with the full violence and everything in them are where you see what we really are without the veneers of civilization. And you'll always see that in the movie. Don't you see that? The guy cuts the girl, and another guy comes, he gets the girl, the guy gets angry, hits the guy, murders the guy. You know, that's how it is. That's the dynamic. But it doesn't work the other way around. Same. So you say, what does work with the man? So let's work it backwards and say, what does the man need when he gets married? What did we say he needs most of all? How does he get his security? Through the respect, through the ego, through the fact that he's the best person. So what is the woman's response? Now the woman notices there's another woman who's taking an interest in him, or another 10 women are taking an interest in him. What is her response? Yeah, I'm the luckiest girl in the world. Look at all the girls who want you. You know what it feels like to be your wife, and you've chosen me. And I feel great. That's fantastic. Look at them. They're all after you. That's fantastic. Not, oh my goodness. No. You follow the difference? Because that makes him feel that his worth as a man is being recognized by his wife. What happens if she says, "I don't like the way that woman's looking at you"? What's his response? I don't mind it. She's looking at me in a way that you never have. And if you don't like it, well, then maybe I'd better review the whole thing. Do you follow the difference? So the response of a woman and a man to damaging relationships have to be completely different. And the setting off of the analysis of that difference is from the way the Torah deals with the time. The first thing we say is, why a woman, not a man? That starts the whole analysis. The Torah would say, if a man or woman, either wanted, A or B, and or he/she, then there's no difference between man and woman. There's no difference in the dynamic. And that's why we've got a lot of the problems that we've got, because people don't understand that. The outcomes are the same. Both want security. Both want love. Both want exclusiveness. But the means of getting that love and security and exclusiveness are opposite in both cases.
I have a question that I've always wondered about as far as that sota. If sota is a punishment for the woman, or at least some sort of relationship between the woman and God enters into this. For a man who then what is the punishment for the man? Or is there none? Is it accepted in the Torah that this is reality, that a man may be polygamous and not be faithful to one wife? Therefore, there is no relationship between him and God as concerning his faith.
No, there is. It's nowhere near as severe. But there is, and there in terms of responsibilities to the other woman, in terms of responsibilities to God, in terms of breaking words, breaking trust, interpersonal relations. It's primarily an interpersonal thing. But if a man were to have a relationship with another woman, who's been to the mikveh and all of that stuff and isn't married and all of that, the main problem is an interpersonal one. He's breaking a trust, he's breaking a relationship, he's damaging another human being. That's the main issue. It's not so much a man-God issue.
Well,
whereas with her case, it is a man God issue.
Not only that, but with Silka, it seems slightly public also. Is it totally private, or is it slightly public?
Well, the Kohen is there. But people know, if she dies, then of course people know about it.
But there doesn't seem to be any equality in divine
recognition. It isn't equality. It isn't equality because the security that a woman wants in marriage comes at a cost, at a high cost of freedom. If you were to place the man under the same restrictions, I guarantee you men wouldn't get married. Just as simple as that. The man would simply say, you know what, I can hire a housekeeper, I can buy sex, and I just don't need it in my life. So if you want to make it all equal, then forget marriage, because no man would agree. But women will agree, because women do feel secure with that exclusivity. It doesn't make a woman claustrophobic, it makes a woman secure. And there are many things like that. The whole issue, one day it'll be an interesting study one day for somebody to do, the impact of claustrophobia on a woman as opposed to a man. I would bet anything that there are situations that men generally find much more claustrophobic than women generally find. A woman finds a certain security in a tight environment. I'm sure that every woman has a point at which she gets claustrophobic, both in relationships and in place. But I think the tolerance levels are different. And the more you entrap a man, the more he breaks out. The more you, if you entrap a woman also, but you can insulate a man and he feels entrapment. I think that's what's important. The more you entrap anybody, the more they break out. But insulation for a woman can feel comfy and secure, and insulation for a man can feel entrapment. And if the condition were, as it is kind of today, and that's why we've got the problems. The problems today are many men are opting to stay single, as are women now as they become more masculine, and many men don't really commit when they take it on. They're not really saying, accepting upon themselves the same level of exclusivity. Otherwise, they wouldn't do what they're doing. So, you're right. It isn't fair in terms of the married relationship is not a fair one. Yeah.
Were there examples? I mean, was this sort of thing done? And was it frequent?
No, it was very infrequent.
Do we know how many died, how many lived, how much was real, how much wasn't real,
or
anything like that?
No, we don't. There's a whole Masechta Sota, there's a whole tractate of Gemara on this piece of Sota. That's a really vitally important piece of Sota. It's an entire tractate of Gemara, and we'll still spend another week or two on it.
If this is the way the relationship is, and it's the way men and women are, why did Hashem make women so they wouldn't want, so they'd be so jealous or feel hurt if she knows a man is interested in her?
Interesting question, and so much so, in fact, that even when there's a legal marriage with a second woman, what is the relationship between the two women called in the Torah? Mm-hmm. Two wives are Torahs, they're called Torahs to one another. It's not an easy relationship. So even when, and that we saw that with Hagar and Sarai, when they're two legal wives, it's a very difficult relationship, and that's why the Torah doesn't recommend it. Why that is so is because if that's the greatest thing for his ego. If she didn't care, if she wasn't jealous, his ego wouldn't be able to survive it.
No, but then he doesn't like it if she's jealous.
Now,
then
it's kind of lose-lose. It's kind of lose-lose, isn't it? No, but
the way she's made. She's
so
not
what,
gonna love it.
So what she, you're right. So what she's got to do with it is she's got to act counterintuitively. If she feels jealous, but her response has got to be not to show her jealousy in anger. Both feel jealous. Don't think the husband doesn't feel jealous. The husband even more so. The question is what they do about that jealousy. So the husband sees the wife with somebody else, he gets very jealous and very confused. She sees very jealous. The jealousy is in both in both cases. The question is the expression of that. If the husband expresses his jealousy in terms of a firm response, and that way the woman feels a degree of security, if the relationship with him is good, of course. If it isn't good, then she doesn't appreciate it at all. Whereas in the case of the woman, she feels jealous and she sort of says to herself, so what do I do about this? If I'm just going to go straight to the point and express my jealousy, that's going to drive him right away. So there's a way around. You asked what the way around was. The way around was to make him feel as esteemed by her as he is by anybody else. And it requires the management of that jealousy rather than...
He's used to her, and she's like bread and butter. She's there all the time, and here he's got a new... And so what's good, I mean, you know, he say, oh, you're just wonderful. And so he's used to that.
That's not just, oh, you're just wonderful. It's actually relating into that kind of thing. The fact that those women find you attractive, I'm so lucky kind of thing. Do you know what I'm saying? That she doesn't ignore the fact, that she doesn't pretend she doesn't notice, nor does she get angry at it at first. Obviously, if things continue, then there's a different kind of response. But the immediate response is one of, that makes me feel more valuable. The fact that you are somebody who could have anybody and have chosen me makes me feel more valuable. And that in turn makes him feel more valuable. So it's a question of how she manages. Of course, every man is different, every relationship. There are no rules for this kind of thing. But the only rule that we are saying is that the way a typical man and a typical woman in those situations, the way each of them manage that jealousy is almost opposite to create the same outcome. At the end of the day, the same outcome is you want the individual to feel more secure in his marriage relationship than in any other potential relationship. The way of achieving that security means understanding the dynamics of what happened under the chuppah. You put a ring on him in the true meaning of that ring, he runs a mile. So you need to know that at the chuppah time in order to figure out how to manage the jealousies later on. So you put a ring on her, she didn't run a mile. So when there's a problem, tie the ring tighter, put another ring on. She did not put a ring on him. When there's a problem, don't try and put a ring on now. There's another solution, there's another way of managing it. That's what one needs to understand. That's the dynamic.